All right, so over the course of next 3 weeks, we are going to learn some fundamental condensed matter physics. And let's start with an introduction. So the next 2 lectures, we are going to develop some framework which we will use to discuss many phenomena that occur in condensed matter physics in the 13 lectures afterwards. Now, let's ask ourselves, let's start by asking a question, what is a particle? Now, we know there are fundamental particles, like quarks and leptons. Now, quarks, there are 6 flavors of quarks. We know up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom. And then there are photon. Photon is a fundamental particle. There are leptons, like electron, that's a fundamental particle. Muon is a fundamental particle. And then Higgs boson, that's a fundamental particle. We also know, why are these fundamental particles? They are called fundamental particles because they have some intrinsic properties. They have some intrinsic mass, they have some charge, they have some spin. Then we can also define something. So let's ask ourselves questions, what is a particle? We know there are some fundamental particles, but what about proton? Or a neutron? Now, are these fundamental particles? No. But they're still particles. They behave like particles. They have mass, they have charge, they have spin. But they're not fundamental also because they're made up of quarks. Proton has 3 quarks, neutron has 3 quarks. So in condensed matter physics, what we will discuss is more along these lines. We'll have many effective particles in condensed matter physics, and these particles, they are not going to be fundamental particles, but they will still have well-defined charge, mass, and spin. So some examples of these condensed matter particles that we'll see in this course is, for example, a Cooper pair, or we'll discuss phonons, or magnons, and so on. Now, what makes condensed matter interesting is that you will have sometimes many particles which are very well understood, particles like electrons, which are fundamental particles, and we know their properties, we know their mass, charge, and spin. You take many of them and you put them together and they behave in strange ways. They behave in ways that could not be expected knowing the individual particles. And to understand this strange behavior, we'll have to develop an entirely new set of tools and concepts so we can understand what is really going on in these systems. And the systems we are interested in are like a piece of metal, a piece of insulator or superconductor. And what we would like to do is to calculate properties of these materials. And we'll develop some tools so that will help us in calculating these properties. And then these properties can be measured in experiments. And these experiments usually verify our theoretical calculations. Now, most of the materials that we will discuss, or most of the problems, they will involve many particles. And most of the experiments done in condensed matter, they are done at low temperature. So at low temperature, quantum mechanics becomes relevant. And what we'll do in this lecture, at least in the first third of it, is we'll try to extend whatever we know from one particle quantum mechanics to a system of n particles, where n can be very large. So we can start with, let's start with single particle Schrödinger equation. Now, this equation is basically, it's called Schrödinger equation. You know this in great detail. So this equation is for one single quantum particle. The first term here can be thought of as the kinetic energy of the particle. This term you can think of as the potential energy. And you've seen also this, sometimes you write this as h psi equal to e psi. So this equation can be solved as an eigenvalue equation. What that means is you can solve this equation, and typically this solution, the solutions of this equation, there will be many solutions. And these solutions, you can label them with some index. So we can solve the single particle equation, single particle Schrödinger equation, and the solutions, we can label them with some index n, r, and these we can call them as eigenvectors or eigenstates. And they will have some eigenvalue en. Now, these eigenstates, they're also referred to as wave functions. So we can also, there are many names you can, so, oh shit. So this psi n of r, this is also called wave function. And what it really represents is it represents a vector in Hilbert space. So this, it is a position representation of a vector psi in Hilbert space. Now, the Hilbert space also comes with a property, which is the inner product. And the inner product in the Hilbert space is defined by so this will be the inner product of two states, two vectors in Hilbert space, psi n and psi m. Now this is a ket, this is a bra, and this is how we define inner product in this Hilbert space. Now there are some special cases. Typically you will have many eigenvalues, en, and corresponding eigenvectors, psi n, they will be linearly independent. There are some special situations when you would have degenerate solutions. What that means is there will be multiple linearly independent eigenstates with same eigenvalue. Now, all this is true for the single particle. You probably all know this in great detail. Some other observations we can make from this is this Hamiltonian is typically Hermitian. What that means is all of the eigenvalues are going to be real. Also, if you take all of the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, then the set of all eigenvectors will form a complete basis. And once you have a complete basis of this Hilbert space, you can expand any state in the Hilbert space in this basis. So let me write down the set. So a set, say psi 1, psi 2, till depends on the size of the Hilbert space, So you basically solve this equation and you tabulate all the solutions. You take all of the solutions, you put them in a set. This is a complete basis set for this Hilbert space. So any state in this Hilbert space can be expanded in terms of these states. Now, another thing that is useful is to define, for example, psi n star r psi n r. This is the probability density of this particle, this single particle. What that means is, so this is the probability density. And if I multiply this, so this is probability density. And let's multiply this by an infinitesimally small volume d cube r. This is the probability of finding this particle at coordinate r within an infinitesimally small volume d cube r. So any questions so far? This is all review so far. So now we would like to extend this, all of these properties, to many particle systems. Now, this is the probability of finding a particle at coordinate r. If we integrate over all the possibilities, we should get one. And this is called the normalization condition. So in condensed matter systems, we'll have many particles. So what we should really try to do is to generalize what we know, what we have done so far, for many particles. Now, if you have many particles, a wave function that represents these many particles would be a function of n coordinates. So let's start with n particles. So if you have n particles, the wave function for this system would be a function of n coordinates. Right? So if we try to do something like this, let's multiply it by its conjugate. So, just this. So, we are doing something like this. So, we are multiplying the wave function of n particle system by its conjugate. So, this should be some probability density. Right? And this is now probability density of this n particle system. What if we multiply this quantity if we multiply this by n infinitesimally small volumes, d cube r1, d cube r2, till d cube rn, this will give us the probability of finding. So this will give us the joint probability of finding one particle at R1, one particle at R2, and one particle at R3 till Rn. So this is the joint probability of finding n particles, one at R1, R2 till Rn, within an infinitesimally small volume element, d cube R1, d cube R2, around these coordinates. So this d cube R1 is a very small volume around R1, and likewise, and you can, this gives you the probability of finding n particles at these coordinates. Now, this is the joint probability. What if you are interested in finding the probability of one particle at R1? Well, that means that all other particles, n minus one of them, are at arbitrary location. So you can simply integrate the n minus one coordinates. So d cube R1, and now I integrate d cube R2 till Rn. This gives me the probability of finding one particle at coordinate R1. Any questions so far? So that's the next thing we'll talk about. So now comes the important question, whether these particles are distinguishable or not. So we have n particles. Now, what does this really mean? So imagine that you have n classical objects, like n classical balls. They all have same, they're identical. What that means is that they have same mass, they have same charge, same all the classical properties. They are same for all of these n classical objects. What you can do for classical objects is you can put a mark on these objects. Let's say you put some number, some mark them numbers 1 to n, and you do this in a way that you, the mass of all of them still remains same. You can actually follow each of these objects in phase space. So you can follow their trajectories if they are classical objects. Now, this is simply impossible in quantum mechanics. You cannot mark a quantum object without influencing the state that this particle is in. So it is simply impossible to distinguish identical particles in quantum mechanics. So if these n particles are identical, for example, let's say all of these n particles are electrons. Electrons, they are all electrons, they all have same charge, same mass, same spin. So they are actually indistinguishable. What that means is if I have a wave function with, now I have n particles, if they're all indistinguishable, what that would mean is if I exchange the coordinates of two particles, so say we have n particles, I exchange two of them. Because they're identical, the physical state that is described by this wave function should remain unchanged, right? So what that means is if I have R1, Rj here, some Rk, Rn. Now, if I exchange j and k, I will get another wave function, which is now, it will be R1, Rk. Rj. What I've done is just exchange one particle at rj with the particle at rk. Now the physical state, because they are indistinguishable particles, should be the same. So what is the most that can happen is between these two states, they must describe the same physical state. So at most, this state, under this operation that you exchange the two, the most that can happen is that this state can get multiplied by a complex constant, complex scalar, so that it still describes the same physical state. So this is where I take J to K, K to J. What if I do this again? So I can do this again. Then I will get lambda square. So I think next time I'll try to leave it in the middle. So now what we'd like to do is to figure out what are the possibilities for this lambda. Any questions so far? So right now, till so far, we've not made any assumptions. These are n quantum particles. We're just talking about the wave function. The most general thing is this lambda, it must be a complex scalar, so we can write it as, say, e to power I phi. So that means lambda square is simply e to the power 2 I phi. Now, this operation of exchanging the two particles, you can think of this operation as a dynamic operation. What that means is, say we have three-dimensional space, we have n particles located at n coordinates, and what you are doing is exchanging one particle that is here with one particle that is here. So you can do this operation by moving one particle around each other and then do this again. So you can think of this process of exchanging the two particles once and then again as moving the particle at J around K and K around J. And you do this in a way that these two particles do not collide. So they avoid each other. And this is equivalent to doing this operation. And if we do this operation twice, the wave function should pick up a phase of e to the power 2 I phi. Now it turns out that you can choose any way of moving these particles around. This phase is independent of the path or independent of the way you are moving them around. Only the final state, you move J and K around each other. It's not important how you moved it. So no matter which path you choose to move them around, you pick up the same phase. So what that means is that you have to look at number of topologically distinct phases that you can get. What that means is find out number of topologically distinct ways of moving two particles around each other. Now in three dimensions or higher, so if you're moving one particle, this is another particle, moving them around, you can do it in many ways. So this was one way, you can do it like this, or like, there are infinitely many ways. All of these ways of exchanging the two particles in three dimensions or higher, it turns out that they can all be contracted to a single point. And because they can all be contracted to a single point, it behaves, they behave as if they did not move at all. So you moved, you exchanged J with K and then K with J. In three dimensions or higher, this operation behaves as if you did not move the particles at all. What that means is that this lambda square should really be equal to 1. What this means is pi should either be 0 or plus 2 pi n, or it should be pi plus multiples of 2 pi. These are the only two possibilities for three dimensions and higher dimensions. If pi is 0, we have a special name for particles which give us a phase of 0, and these are called bosons. If the phase is pi, we'll call them fermions. Now it turns out that in two dimensions, not all ways of moving the particles around can be contracted to a single point. So in two dimensions, you can get values of this phase phi, which is not zero or pi. And these are called anions. And in the tutorial today, you will discuss more about anions. But they're only there in two dimensions. By the way, let's try to do this in 1D. In 1D, if you have many particles, say this is RJ, and this is RK, you cannot move them around in 1D without them colliding. So this exchange is simply not possible in 1D. In 2D, you have larger phase space, so you can still exchange. Imagine this plane being the 2D, so you can still exchange the two particles, move them around. But you can get phases which are different than 0 and pi. And this would be one problem in the tutorial today. So let's just write down one expression, which we'll use later on. So we have particles, let's say, the wave function R1, RJ, RK, RN. This would be equal to either plus or minus. Depending on whether these particles that you exchanged, they were bosons or fermions. You can apply this to two particles. Let's apply this to two fermions. So let's take two fermions. Let's say these two fermions are at R1 and R2. When we exchange them, we'll get R2, R1, and we must pick up a minus sign. Right? What if we had two fermions at the same point? Well, let's exchange them. We get the same thing. This implies that this must be zero. This is called Pauli's exclusion principle, that two fermions cannot be at the same coordinate. Now, this exchange that we did of coordinates, there is nothing special about the position representation of the wave function. We can use, for example, momentum representation and also do the exchange, and we'll conclude that the two particles cannot have the same momentum. In fact, you can generalize this statement and say that two fermions cannot be in the same quantum state. And this generalized concept is called Pauli's exclusion principle. And it gives rise to many interesting properties for a condensed matter system. And we'll discuss that later on. So another way to denote these exchange is we will call that, we'll use fermions are anti-symmetric. Under exchange, and bosons are symmetric . What this means is, for fermions, what this means is you have two fermions. When you exchange them, you get a minus sign. And if you have bosons, you'll get a plus sign. Now what if we had two bosons? If we had two bosons, and let's say both of them were at the same coordinate, and we exchange them, we don't get this minus sign. So there is no problem for two bosons to be at the same point. There is no exclusion principle for bosons. In fact, this gives rise to many interesting properties, that it turns out to minimize free energy for multiple bosons at zero temperature. To minimize free energy, all of these bosons will actually go to the same state, unlike fermions. And this is known as Bose-Einstein condensation. A phenomena very similar to this occurs in superconductivity, where we get Bose-Einstein condensation or Bose-Einstein condensate of an effective particle called Cooper pairs, which again we'll discuss later on in the class. So keep in mind that the simple exchange statistics, this exchange behavior for identical particles, can give rise to many interesting properties. Any questions so far? Okay, so far we discussed some general properties of n particle wave functions. We can ask ourselves, is there a way to write these n particle wave functions in terms of single particle wave functions? So how should we do that? Well, let's first start with a complete set of single particle eigenstates. Let's first write down, this is for a single particle. So you can solve this single particle Schrodinger equation, and you can calculate all of the single particle eigenstates. So say you found out psi 1, psi 2. You've calculated all of them. Now, we know we have n particles. So if we want to express the wave function in terms of these single particle states, we should need at least n of these states. So choose n of these single particle states. So we have n particles. Our goal is to write an n particle wave function in terms of single particle wave functions. Let's make a big assumption that these particles are not interacting with each other. So if these particles are not interacting, that means they behave as if they're independent particles and that are well described by single particle quantum mechanics. So if they're not interacting with each other, one way you can think of expressing this single particle state or many particle wave function, n particle wave function, is by product of n single particle wave functions. Now, these states, there can be many of them. And we said we will choose n of these. So let's assume that these single particle states, they are labeled by some quantum number. Let's call it Ki. So Ki can go from 1 to, depending on the dimension of the Hilbert space, to the, let's say, infinity. And we will choose n of these single particle states to write down the n particle wave function. So what we want to do is we can write down, we can label the many particle wave function as psi 1, psi k1, k2, kn, and so what this means is I have n particles. They are at the coordinates of these n particles are denoted by r1, r2, to rn. I have chosen n single particle states, and these n single particle states are each labeled by the quantum number k1, k2, till kn. So these are n distinct single particle states labeled by these quantum numbers. Now, one way you can think of writing this wave function is by simply multiplying all of the so this is simply a product over Ki, the quantum numbers. So this is one way of writing an n particle wave function, non-interacting one. Now, you can write it this way, but this turns out not to be a very useful way of writing it. Why? Let's assume that we exchange two particles, the first one and the second one. So if we exchange them, what we get is psi k1, now we'll have r2 here, psi k2, r1. The rest remains same. Now, if I write this product and I compare it with this product, it's not obvious whether they are both related by plus or minus sign, right? So we know from what we discussed about exchange that this must be equal to plus or minus times psi k1 r1 right. So what we would like to do is to develop a formalism or develop a way of writing n particle wave functions in terms of n single particle wave functions, which encodes this fundamental symmetry of bosons or fermions in the wave function itself. Now, this fundamental symmetry cannot be broken by any perturbation. So if under exchange, either you'll get a plus sign for bosons, or you'll get minus sign for fermions, this symmetry cannot be broken by any perturbation. So it's very useful to just encode this symmetry in the way we write the n particle wave function. Now, this can be done, and to do this, what we need to do is to treat all of these coordinates on equal footing. What that means is the quantum number k1 here is associated with the particle coordinate r1. We would like to have allow for all of the coordinates r1, r2, rn, that all of these coordinates are possible for all of the quantum numbers. So if we allow for this possibility, and in this way we'll treat all of these coordinates on equal footing, so each quantum number can describe any of the coordinate, any of the particle at that coordinate. And by using this, we can write an n particle wave function that encodes this exchange symmetry. The way we would do this is, we start with this product state, and what we would do is we'll apply an operator that is denoted by S plus minus, and we'll call this S with the plus sign, we'll call this as symmetrization operator, and with minus sign, it will be the anti-symmetrization operator. And this operator acting on the product state . So let me define what this operator does to this product state. It will give you a constant, which we write as n square root of n factorial. And then so basically, I'm writing what is called for fermions Slater determinant. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to write all possible combinations of these quantum numbers k1 to kn and the coordinates r1 to rn.
Let's move this up.
This plus or minus goes with the plus and minus of the symmetrization or anti-symmetrization. What that means is if you have the minus sign, then it is just like the determinant that you already know. If it is the plus sign, that means all of the terms, when you expand the determinant, are actually plus. So you have no minus signs. So how many terms are going to be there? So how many terms are going to be, how many permutations are possible? N factorial. So the prefact or the factor of 1 over square root n factorial is related to this, and it's a normalization factor. And in the tutorial today, you would prove this explicitly. So any questions so far? So another way you can, we can just try to write it down for two fermions and two bosons. So if I have only two fermions, I can just do two single particle states. Let's choose K1, K2, R1, R2. This, if because I have fermions, I should use the anti-symmetrization operator. So I will get 2 factorial. And then the determinant, which is like K1, R1, K2, R1. This is simply like K1. Now, if you can see from this expression that if you exchange R1 and R2, you do get a minus sign as is required by the fundamental symmetry of fermions. Right? Now, this is just an example. For two particles, for three particles, you will have more terms. For n particles, you'll have n factorial terms in this. If you write it like this, expand all the terms, you'll have n factorial terms. So it's a way of writing the wave function or n particle wave function, which simply encodes this symmetry. It might look messy, but it is useful because it includes the exchange symmetry in it. Now, if you do the same thing for bosons, if you have two bosons, you will get the plus sign, and you can exchange them. You will not get any sign change. Now, so far, the particles that we are trying to write the wave function of are assumed to be non-interacting. So what if the particles are interacting? Now, if the particles are interacting, then a lot can happen. The wave functions need not be, you might not be able to express the n particle wave function for an interacting system as a simple product of n single particle wave functions, or many combinations of it. But what you can do is you can build up a complete basis of the n particle Hilbert space, and then you can expand any general state, whether it's interacting or not, in this basis. So let's see what that means. So imagine you have two particles, just this example, K1 and K2. You remember we we assumed this. So we solved the single particle wave function or single particle Schrodinger equation, and we have many solutions. We find out all of the solutions. If you sum over all possibilities of K1 and K2, that would form a complete basis for Hilbert space of two particles. You have to sum over all possible values of K1 and K2. So if this Schrodinger equation, say, has 100,000 solutions, you have to sum over all 100,000 values for K1 and K2. And that would be a complete basis. And then you can write any state in terms of this. So let me write down a general expression, and then we can discuss that in detail. So now I'm writing an n particle wave function. So I have, let's say, R1, R2, Rn. This can be written as sum over K1, K2, till Kn. Some coefficient that depends on K1, K2, till Kn times those wave functions, psi K1, K2, Kn, R1. These states, so I can just write them here. So this term is a sum. So on this is a very general, this is a general wave function for n quantum particles, n identical particles. This wave function can be expanded in a complete basis set. And the basis set is complete if we sum over all possible values of k's. K1, so K1 takes all possible values, K2 takes all possible values, and Kn takes all possible values. We have some coefficients, and multiplying each coefficient is this wave function. And this wave function can be written as a determinant or permanent. So if you have all signs that are positive in that, instead of determinant, you have something which is called a permanent. This is simply the symmetrization or anti-symmetrization operator on product states K1, R1, So we have found one way of expressing an n particle wave function in terms of something that we know very well. So we know single particle quantum mechanics very well. We can solve the single particle Schrodinger equation, calculate all of the solutions. Once we have all of the solutions, we have n particles. We choose n labeled with, say, k1 to kn, these solutions. We choose n of them. We construct a symmetrized or anti-symmetrized product, depending on whether these particles are bosons or fermions. Then we sum over all of these k's, the values of these quantum numbers, and then we have a way of writing this wave function. Once you have this wave function, you can go ahead and calculate any physical property, expectation value of any observable that you may want to measure in the lab. And that's it. It turns out that this is not really that useful. We can do it, And it's easy to think about this starting from single particle quantum mechanics, but in actually performing calculations, there are, if you like to develop some tools which are a bit easier. So what we would like to do is, instead of using these determinants, develop a framework where you express the many-body quantum state or many-body wave function in terms of occupation numbers of these states. So you choose n, or you have many single particle states. We would try to develop a formalism where we can express the state of n particles by just expressing how many particles are there in a given single particle state. And then we'll try to make a complete basis out of this. And this whole procedure is called second quantization. And what this will lead us to is, this will lead us to defining operators like creation operator or annihilation operator and the number operator for a given single. So we can define these operators for a single particle state. And then we can construct the many particle wave function by specifying the number of particles in these single particle states. Any questions so far? So next, we'd start with second quantization. So what we have done so far, you can call it first quantization if you want. So in the way we'll do this is, let's break it down into two steps. Step one, we choose, or we solve the single particle Schrödinger equation, and we find all of the solutions of these. So we solve Hψ equal to Eψ, and we calculate the solutions, and these solutions are these states. So depending on the size of the Hilbert space for single particle, you will have that many solutions. What we would like to do, step two, is to develop a formalism where a many particle state is written like this. So I solve the single particle Schrödinger equation. I calculate all of the single particle states, and I will write the state of the n particle system or many body system in terms of occupation numbers for each of these states. Any questions so far? So this first quantization way of expressing the wave function can be useful if you have, say, few particles. If you have 2 particles, 3 particles, 10 particles, still you can do it. But because n factorial can really be a large number, if you have, say, 10 to the power 23 particles, it's not a very practical way of doing calculations. And typically in a metal or in a piece of superconductor, in these materials, you do have large number of particles. Now, for fermions, we know that the number can only be either 0 or 1. You cannot have more than 1 fermion in a single particle state. So 2 fermions cannot be in the same quantum state, right? So each of these single particle states can at most have 1 fermion. So if I want to write an n particle state for fermions, I will choose these single particle states and I will give occupation numbers. Now, you can choose many. You can say like, okay, many of them will be zero and at least n of them have to be one. They can be anywhere in principle. So you would seem like, okay, they can still be anywhere. Where, how does this help? This seems like it doesn't really help. It's just rephrasing the problem. The help comes in the following way, that these states, you can think of them as ordered. For example, if we start at zero temperature, so let's assume that we are at zero temperature. So free energy is same as the energy U. So the system will try to minimize its free energy. So at zero temperature, the system will try to minimize its energy. If all of these single particle states are labeled in increasing order of energy, then the way you can minimize energy is by start filling up the states starting from below. So if you have n particles, the lowest possible state, you give number one, then the next one, then the next one, and you fill up all of them till you exhaust all of the n particles. So for fermions, this is a procedure that helps us. And the state, the energy at which you have to stop is called Fermi energy. So we see that this way of doing or writing the wave function can be useful at least at very low temperature, at least at zero temperature. And then later on in the course, we'll study cases when temperature is not zero and still it's small enough that we can use the... So if we have total n lowest energy states fill, this we can call as Fermi C, or the energy is Fermi level. All energy levels below the Fermi energy are filled. We'll try to increase the temperature so that it's not zero. And the excitations or the state of the system at finite temperature will see that we can still write them as perturbations along this filled Fermi C. So my goal here is to convince you that, okay, this is one representation. We can do this for n particle wave functions, but this way is slightly more useful and practical, especially when it comes to performing calculations and predicting properties. For bosons, as we discussed earlier, it is more tricky in the sense that these occupation numbers can be anything. So overall, because we have total n particles, we must have sum over occupation numbers of all of these states. This must be equal to n. So next, what we would like to do is like to discuss states like this. An important property for these states, if we want, so our goal is to use states like this as basis states, and then we can expand a general many-body state in terms of these basis states. So the property that we want to stress is we should have these states, they should be orthonormal. So this means that if you have different occupation numbers, M1, M2, so these basis states would show that they're orthonormal. And to do this, we'll need to define creation and annihilation operators for these single particle states. So, any questions so far?
Yeah, you said that when we have an interacting theory, we might have to sum over the Slater determinants, or whatever, or permanence.
Yeah.
What are the quantum numbers in the non-interacting picture?
So, in the non-interacting, say...
interacting single particle quantum numbers?
So, you can, for example, they can be like momentum values. So, say you have only kinetic energy, there is no potential energy, so your Hamiltonian is only p squared over 2m, so you can, the solutions, you can label them with plane waves, and these plane waves have some momentums. So you will have to sum over all the momentums. So there is, it's a way of writing interacting system in terms of non-interacting one, but may not be practical.
Right. You know.
What it is useful is to build some approximations and get some intuition. Any other questions? So another thing that we can discuss from this is, so far we have assumed that these states, so we made this conclusion that if we label the states, the fermionic states, with these quantum numbers k's, k1, k2, kn, so far we are ignoring the spin of the particles. If we label them with momentum quantum numbers, like for plane waves, each fermion will, for example, each electron with spin half will have two values of spin, up and down. So each state k1 can be at most occupied by two particles, one with spin up, one with spin down. So when I write these n1, n2, for the moment, we are not including spin. So if this state, so for the moment, we are assuming that each state can have two values for spin. So this n1, for example, you can think of this as orbital quantum number and spin quantum number. So if these nu one, nu two, these quantum numbers, they, you can think of them as orbital quantum numbers. Each of them will have degeneracies, spin degeneracies. Of, if these are L, then you'll have 2L plus 1 states for each orbital quantum number. So you can have at most 2L plus 1 fermions in each orbital state, each orbital quantum number. Any other general questions about what you expect to learn from condensed matter, or any idea? So tomorrow we'll start from second quantization, and then we'll discuss various phenomena. We'll try to explain materials such as metals, superconductors, or insulators, and magnetism, and so on, and quantum Hall effect. And depending on how much time we have, we'll cover all these topics in great detail. Is there anything that you, any other questions that you would like to ask about condensed matter in general, or any other expectations from what you want to learn? Or okay, so let's stop here, and tomorrow will be another class, which will be a bit formal, and after that we'll discuss more physical phenomena.